The Tampa Bay Lightning are right back in it in the Stanley Cup playoffs. We discussed the matchups so far. A couple of coaches landing in some new destinations. It could be offer sheet season. Johnny Gaudreau set to maybe make a big decision soon. And a big trade between the Canadiens and the Vegas Golden Knights that we'll break down as well. All coming up here in episode 138 of the Second Thoughts Hockey Podcast. Let's go. Welcome in. It is a hot Tuesday edition of the Second Thoughts Hockey Podcast. Kyle Grimard here, your host as always. Make sure you follow along on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Instagram, and Twitter at ST Hockey Podcast. Another piece out on the Hockey Writers involving Mr. Bo Horvat, his new deal, comparables to around the league. I put a lot of work into that one, so if you would like to go check it out, it is at the Hockey Writers. I'll try and share it as well on the Second Thoughts Hockey Podcast page. All right, 2-1. We have got ourselves a series. Colorado, after dominating game two, Tampa Bay right back in it, dominating game number three by a score of 6-2. We'll get to that in just a little bit. A couple coaches have landed in some areas. Who's left? And there's one. Basically, I'm going to go over which coaches I was right about, which coaches I wasn't so right about. Offer sheet season could be. There's a lot of RFAs up for grabs, and could this be the year that we see an offer sheet? Maybe more. Johnny Gaudreau also making a big decision, depending on whether he's going to stay in Calgary or maybe test the open market, and a trade between Vegas and Montreal. We'll break down, decipher, discuss how it benefits both teams. But we start with the Stanley Cup playoffs and game three. Colorado up 2-0 going into Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay, they came back swinging.
Here's Pat Maroon to the net. The big man in his 21st Stanley Cup final game. It's 5-2.
And the Lightning would then cruise to a 6-2 victory over the Colorado Avalanche. That series now 2-1. There will be no sweep this time. And game four gets set, I believe, for tomorrow. First of all, because three games have happened, right? I don't just want to highlight game three that took place. Game one was relatively close, but Colorado seemed like the quicker team. Game two from the start, and I heard a comment from Elliot Freeman discussing this, and I wonder if this is true or not. But he said, Tampa Bay, when Andrei Vasilevsky is on, the Lightning are on. But when they notice a little, you know, little hinge in the armor of Vasilevsky, they kind of deteriorate as well. And it was evidenced by some of the goals that Vasilevsky were giving up. Mainly the Josh Manson goal on the 2-on-1, where Josh Manson, who is not known as a scorer, comes in on a 2-on-1 with, I believe, Andrew Cogliano, who was coming back from an injury due to his hand. So he didn't have much of a shot. And you could just tell the angle that Vasilevsky takes is just off. And you can almost tell after this puck went in, Tampa Bay, they just knew
it. With Delmar and Maroon, but out comes Cogliano. And Helm with Sturm. Shot scores!
You know, you don't normally see guy, like, it takes a special shooter to beat Andrei Vasilevsky in a one-on-one. And it's not a diss to Josh Manson has arguably been one of the best deadline pickups of the trade deadline time this year. Obviously, he's competing in the Stanley Cup Finals. Brandon Hagel's another one from Tampa Bay, but you normally wouldn't peg Josh Manson out of 10 times to beat Vasilevsky one-on-one with a shot. And great shot, but Vasilevsky, the angle's not there. And just the mood. Every time Vasilevsky gets up, he looked tired. He looked exhausted. It looked like finally a three-year run was wearing on him. And then Tampa Bay. And then game three happened. And Tampa Bay goes, no. It's like Tampa Bay uses outside of the Florida series. It's like Tampa Bay uses the first couple games, the first few games, to figure out their opponent. Toronto, game one, 5-0, Toronto dominated. Game two, Tampa came back, then Toronto game three. But after a while, Tampa like started clamping down on the series. Florida was a sweep. That one wasn't even close. The Rangers, down 2-0 in New York. They go back to Tampa. Tampa clamps it down. They figure it out. Games one and two, Colorado. Game one, close-ish. Colorado was definitely the better team. And then game two was just an absolute dominant performance. Tampa starts figuring it out. Cale Makar was like a minus two. All the big boys get on the board. They didn't even have point. You know, it's been 3 years of this. I was talking to a buddy and I said, wow, Colorado looks really good. And we were saying like, you know, this could be the year. But you never, and I made that mistake, you never count out Tampa Bay. I don't care if it's 3-0 series lead for Colorado, 5-0 in the third period. It's unwise to bet against the Tampa Bay Lightning. It's been unwise for three straight years. Now, Colorado is as good of a team as Tampa Bay has played. They're easily the best team that Tampa has played. And their speed is evident. And Colorado will come back and it will be a better game four. But this is what Tampa does. They take a few games, unless it's the Florida series. They figure it out. And then they start making their adjustments. That's what good teams do, right? You hear this in football all the time, right? When a rookie comes into the league and lights it up, right? A quarterback, let's just say. And a quarterback's lighting up defenses, and he's great. But then year two, there's a sophomore slump. Do you want to know why there's a sophomore slump? Because now teams have tape on the guy. They know his tendencies. They know his go-tos. They know his tells. Then it's on the quarterback to make adjustments. It's easy, not saying it's easy, but coming out and playing for a game is a lot easier than doing it over the course of a series. And that's what happens with Tampa Bay. You can get them for a game, but it is very rare you do it for four. And that's what no team has done in 3 years, is take Tampa four games. Toronto is the closest this year at three. Colorado's halfway there to 4-2. It's going to sound like the most obvious statement on planet Earth, but in my opinion, in game four, I think whoever wins game four, that will be the deciding factor. I could be totally wrong. If Tampa wins game four, this thing's dead even. Now it's just a heat race, and Tampa, all they got to do is find a way to win a game on the road. They did that against the Rangers. They did it against the Leafs. But if Colorado wins game four, they're up 3-1 going back home. And all you've got to do is win one of the next three games, two of which are in your home building. It is monumental. It's more important. In my opinion, game four is more important than game five. Because game four is the setup game. Tampa wins, we're deadlocked to two. Huge momentum swing for them. They cover at home, Colorado covers at home. But if Colorado wins game four, all the momentum, the building's rocking. Tampa's been on the verge already this postseason, but it was 3-2, right? You win a game at home and then God knows what happens. But if it's 3-1, you've got to win in Colorado, then you've got to win at home, and then you've got to go back and win in Colorado. That is a monumentally more difficult task than winning game six at home and then whatever happens game seven, or if that even happens. Game four is monumental. Monumental. For the Avalanche, they finally got a little bit of pushback. You know, in fairness, their series against the Blues was probably Colorado's hardest series till this point. Right, they swept Nashville, they swept Edmonton. There was like a little pushback from Edmonton, but it was game to game, and Colorado ended up coming on top. St. Louis was the series, for the most part, where they received the most pushback. And even then, Colorado, you could feel like Colorado was just overwhelmingly the better team. But this is like the difference of feeling from games two to game three are so different. Because after game two, everybody's like, wow, Colorado might not lose a game again. And then Tampa swings back and all of a sudden it's a 6-2 performance. Darcy Kuemper did not look good. He did not look good. I don't feel great about Darcy Kuemper. And that game, just the goals that were beating him, I didn't love it. And I'm a little, like, I don't know. Colorado did everything they could possibly do in games one and two. They got them. They got to Vasilevsky. But Vasilevsky looked good yesterday, made a couple really big saves. Once that dude gets locked in, like Elliot Friedman said, if Vasilevsky gets locked in, then the Lightning seem to lock in and they shut down a little bit. And Colorado scored first still, and then Tampa Bay responded, retaliated. Now I want to see how Colorado does with a team like Tampa. You're going against the best goaltender who looked way better in game three at home. You've got Tampa Bay who they were missing Braden Point. And they, I don't know if he's still going to be available. Now, Colorado's also missing some guys. Kadri and Burakovsky did not play in game three. Those are two very big pieces. You need your big boys. You need the McKinnon. I know Landeskog scored. But you need, this is where your big boys, you're at the final leg of the race. This is where they got to pull through. And Tampa's guys know how to do it. Tampa also knows how to clamp things down. Like, Tampa doesn't need to win 6-2. We saw them do this against Toronto. They'll clamp down your big guns, and they'll eke out a 2-1 win. They'll eke out a 3-2 win. 4-3 in overtime. You know, Colorado needs to keep this offense going. They also need to score a 5-on-5 goal. Did you see this, by the way? Tampa Bay at home. I believe they played what? 6 games since the first, since round one. But I'm going to read you a stat here. And you're not going to believe this, okay? The Lightning have not allowed a 5-on-5 goal at home since game 6 of the first round against Toronto. They've played 6 straight home games. 2 versus the Panthers, 3 versus the Rangers, 1 versus the Avs. The last goal was Tavares at the end of the second period in game 6 against the Leafs. That's the last 5-on-5 goal Tampa Bay has given up at home. And I've even noticed on the road, a lot of goals are power play goals. We got to cut these down. Like, I get calling the rule book. Like, I'm for calling the rule book, but I'm calling the rule book and I'm finding a line when it is genuinely a penalty, when it is something that is impacting the flow of play. But these light little, you know, little taps on the hand, these little, oh, your stick and a player falls down. You know what I mean? Like, the officials got to do a better job and be like, listen, we're not buying what you're selling. It needs to be something egregious where the play is impacted. That's when I think a call should be. I just remember watching game two in Colorado. It was like every other 3 minutes I was watching. Colorado's on the power play. Every time, every goal I was watching highlights, it's Colorado starts with the power play. Because 5-on-5, that Tampa team is dangerous. And Colorado's got to find a way to put the puck in the back of the net at 5-on-5. The last time Tampa gave up a goal at home 5-on-5 was in round one against the Leafs. Absolutely insane, in my opinion. Okay, we got to move on here and discuss a couple different things. One, a few different head coaches have landed and have been given positions. They have taken on roles. A few different sources have reached out. I will start with Peter DeBoer, who was named the head coach of the Dallas Stars. This one makes sense to me. You know, DeBoer and Dallas just kind of go together. It's apparently a 4-year contract. You know what's funny? is coaches' deals were never really discussed in terms of like salary and how much money they're going to make, but this one's a 4-year deal worth $4 million per season. He was hired by Vegas after failing to reach the playoffs this past season. He has been all, of course, as well with the San Jose Sharks. He got them to the Stanley Cup final, and he was actually with New Jersey in 2012 too. But the role just makes a lot of sense. Teams that are still looking for vacancies right now include Boston, Detroit, Winnipeg. And as we move on to that, the Philadelphia Flyers hire Mr. John Tortorella. This one we called last episode on the podcast. I said Tortorella there is just, it just fits. It just matches. His energy, his vibe, the way he handles himself is very Philadelphia, specifically the organization and like their fan base and what they embody as a team. Torts there makes a lot of sense. Bruce Cassidy going to Vegas. So Vegas makes the move. I thought they were going to go after Trotz. Cassidy also makes a lot of sense. This move to me showed that Vegas got impatient. Vegas did not want to wait on Barry Trotz. Tortorella made his decision. DeBoer was still there as well. But Vegas, I don't want to say they panicked, but they got a little impatient. They got a little frantic and they said, we need a decision. Trotz said, I'm going to make it on July 1st. Vegas was like, well, if you're not choosing us, we're screwed because DeBoer's off the books. Tortorella's off the books. You know, Cassidy was still sitting there. He could have been off the books as well. The Panthers are still looking for a head coach. The Red Wings are still looking for a head coach. And they went, no, we're going to make this decision. They brought in Bruce Cassidy. And to Bruce Cassidy's, you know, credit, he has done an immaculate job in Boston. Why wouldn't you bring him? He's worked with star players. He knows, you know, it's a completely different division, but he's had a pretty good track record with a really good organization, one that's been fairly successful. He goes to another team that outside of last year has had a very good track record of success, literally from the moment they came into the league. That makes a lot of sense to me. Where I'm wrong is where Barry Trotz is on the market, and apparently the Winnipeg Jets are in a really good spot to possibly land him. All the local businesses are offering Trotz free whatever, ice cream, beer, smoked meat sandwiches. I don't know what's going on up there. The deal's probably going to be worth like between six and seven million dollars. If DeBoer gets four from Dallas, I think Trotz is going to get, I would say, the very bare minimum's five. I think he probably gets around $6 million, maybe $6.5 million. But that's where I was wrong, because I thought Trotz would go to Vegas. But because Trotz is really taking his time, he's contemplating a lot of things. But I will say this about Winnipeg. Winnipeg is basically saying to Trotz, if you come here, we will give you the keys to the kingdom. You have full creative control over your assistants, the program, what you want to do. Because this past year was a really tough year in Winnipeg. It was. The goaltending was not where it was expected to be, even though Hellebuyck was still pretty decent. The star players did not hold up. Defensively, they were kind of a mess. And this was a team a lot of people said could potentially be one of the better Canadian teams and be one of the, I don't know, like four, maybe five teams contending in the West, or at least, you know, pushing, could go on a run. When you got a goaltender, you always have that. And they have that in Hellebuyck. I could be wrong. I could really be wrong about Barry Trotz, and he could go to Winnipeg. I was bang on about Torts. DeBoer makes sense. We're still waiting to see on a couple other guys. Also, the Edmonton Oilers and Jay Woodcroft, apparently they're nearing a 3-year contract. This was reported a little bit earlier, but 3 days ago or so, from ESPN's Kevin Weeks. Edmonton went on just a run with Woodcroft. They were 26-9-3 with him down the stretch before going to the conference finals. That's like the honeymoon phase. I want to see how they do now. You know what I mean? Like, this happened with the Leafs. They fired Mike Babcock. They brought on Sheldon Keefe. They went on this miraculous little run, right? New coach, new voice, a little bit more energy in the room. They go on to the playoffs. Same thing for the Oilers. Oilers were struggling. Woodcroft comes in. They don't even lose 10 games in regulation. They go to the conference. You know what I mean? Like, it's all great. But now I want to see how the Oilers are next season. Because it's the same voice. Maybe some things are a little stale. It's the same, you know, metaphor I used with NFL quarterbacks. Okay, so teams now have tape on your systems. They have tape on how you play. And I know there's only so much you can do against McDavid and Draisaitl. But now teams can adjust. They can play you a little differently. Now I want to see how the Oilers continue to get better. That'll be really intriguing. That's kind of it right now. We'll see in terms of what other coaches still remain. Like I mentioned a little bit earlier, some of the teams are still looking for a coach include Boston, Detroit, the Jets, as we said. We'll have to kind of wait and see. Florida's still looking as well. But it's going to be very, very intriguing, to say the least. Okay, I want to get to this next topic here because it's one that I feel like always gets talked about and then nothing really happens for it. But of all the years, this could be a year for offer sheets. There are a few different players on a few different organizations that are in a situation where they are RFAs and the team doesn't necessarily have, let's just say, a substantial amount of cap space in order to make that happen. Let me give you an example. The Toronto Maple Leafs right now are probably sitting at about $7.8, nearly $8 million in cap space. They have Pierre Engvall, Andre Kasha, and Ilya Mikheyev as guys to work out. Two of them are RFAs, Engvall and Kasha. They've also got Timothy Liljegren and Rasmus Sandin. Two defensemen, 23 and 22 years of age, that are RFAs. Does an offer sheet at $4 million or $5 million for a guy price Toronto out of it? Maybe. Maybe, maybe not. Does a team really like Andre Kasha or Pierre Engvall? The Oilers have $7 million in cap space. And they have Kyler Yamamoto, Jesse Puljujärvi, Ryan McLeod, all RFAs. Next year, they will have Evan Bouchard as an RFA. If teams look at Kyler Yamamoto, who can play center and right wing, 23, and throw an offer sheet at him at like a year at 5'5", you know the teams that could afford that? There are a few. Or if they want to go Jesse Puljujärvi. Let's go to the Calgary Flames, another team who have a lot of decisions that they need to make right now. And this will be a perfect segue. They've got Matthew Tkachuk and Andrew Mangiapane and about $26 million in cap space. They've got the cap space to sign both guys. They also have Johnny Gaudreau that they need to sign. They also have Oliver Kylington, who's an RFA. Gabranson, Stone, Zadorov. That's a lot of players who they've got to figure out. Mangiapane is a 30-goal scorer this year. Tkachuk's probably going to get signed. And let's just say Gaudreau signs as well. But between those guys, that's like what? Close to $20 million, maybe more? You've got $6 million left for Andrew Mangiapane, Kylington, Zadorov. You know, does an offer sheet come that prices Andrew Mangiapane out of the building? He's only 26, can play both the left and right wing. There's a lot of difficult decisions that need to be made. Carolina, weirdly, has a lot of cap space, but they've got to sign Trocheck and Nino Niederreiter and Max Domi. Martin Nietzsche is an RFA. Ethan Bear is an RFA. Tony D'Angelo is an RFA. It's a lot of guys RFAs, and they've got about $19 million. The Rangers have $11 million. They've got Kaapo Kakko as an RFA. Andrew Copp's a UFA. They've got to re-sign Ryan Strom, Frank Vatrano. Does someone throw an offer sheet at Kaapo Kakko at just 21 years of age? I don't know. Offer sheets are always something that gets talked about, and then it never happens. But maybe maybe in a year where there's so much uncertainty and there's so many teams that are pressed, like there are teams right now that there are two teams that are currently, quote, over the cap. Tampa, Vegas. We'll get to them in a second. But like Tampa's going to have some decisions to make. They've got Palat, Paul, Riley Nash, all UFAs. Jan Ruda, UFA. They're going to have to figure a lot of things out. And speaking of the signing players and RFA and all that fun stuff, the guy I want to lead into here is set to make a decision soon about whether he's going to re-up and sign with the Calgary Flames, depending on the offer, or maybe test the market. Now, a couple different things. One, this will decide where Johnny Gaudreau, what he feels about A, situation in Calgary, and B, maybe there's a fit that he likes better. So he absolutely crushed it this year. It was a career high in literally every statistical category. Career high in goals, he had 40 for the first time ever. His previous high was 36 in 2018-2019. 75 assists, same thing, career high in 2018-19 was 63 and 115 points. He was nuts. He was, by the way, a plus 64. The amount of 5-on-5 goals he was on the ice for is absolutely insane. He's probably going to get... It easily is a double-digit number. I look at Panarin, maybe an 11, possibly 12. But apparently, according to Elliot Friedman, Johnny Gaudreau is making the decision, and we'll come to that decision hopefully soon. But that's going to be a very, very big call. It either opens up a lot of room potentially for Calgary to get creative, but also Johnny Gaudreau was the lifeblood of that team. He was the leading point getter. He also had 15 points in 12 playoff games, or 14 points. Like he was very solid. But it's always tough signing a player after a career year. And Johnny Gaudreau is coming off a very team-friendly for this year, $6.75 million contract extension. He signed that, by the way, it was a six-year deal in 2016 before the year started. And this year of all years, grossly outplayed that deal. For the most part, played up to that deal. But now we'll see what that decision is and could have major impact on what things transpire to be moving forward. But nevertheless, I am very intrigued to see what happens in the coming weeks, possibly days. I don't know when the timeline is for that, but nevertheless, it's going to be very, very intriguing to see how this goes. I do want to get to a couple different news stories before we head on out here and just kind of dive in a little bit more, but there was a trade that took place between the Montreal Canadiens and the Vegas Golden Knights that is going to have major positives for both teams. The Canadiens trade captain Shea Weber to the Vegas Golden Knights for forward Evgeny Dadonov, the team announced Thursday. So the trade for Montreal is to alleviate themselves of a little cap and Weber's $7.86 million contract until 2026. The Golden Knights get a player off of their roster, Evgeny Dadonov, and about $4 to $5 million, and will take Shea Weber and put him on LTIR, giving them even more cap flexibility. We saw it this year from Vegas. They had trouble when they were somewhat healthy before injuries ravaged them. They couldn't have everybody in the lineup. Eichel, Stone, Pacioretty, Lehner, Theodore Petrangelo, they all make huge bucks. And Dadonov was a player, if you remember, they tried to trade at the deadline, and apparently the deal was not done properly due to this, the rules surrounding the league and the trade implications about Dadonov and waiving his no trade. Apparently he didn't specifically waive it to this team, and the trade got denied. So Vegas was not stuck, but they were forced to keep Dadonov, who ended up actually playing really well down the stretch. But now the deal gets made. Dadonov's off the roster. Now they bring on Shea Weber. Weber's deal now goes to LTIR. And that is why, on Cap Friendly, when you go to the Vegas Golden Knights, they are currently $2 million over the salary cap. Why is that? Well, because Shea Weber is now a part of the organization. He will go on LTIR, and they will buy out and get a pretty good amount of relief come the regular season. There's 4 years left on that. What this allows them to do is extend themselves a little bit going into the regular season to afford them to keep on Mark Stone, Eichel, Pacioretty, Marchessault, Chandler Stephenson, and all those guys. They've also got a couple players that they gotta, in the next coming years, figure out. Brett Howden is a player who's an RFA. Nicholas Hägg is an RFA. Riley Smith is a UFA. Now, he's on IR at the moment, but you know what I mean here. For Montreal, Montreal gets their guy off their cap right now. They get Shea Weber. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like he's going to play a game again. But Montreal right now has got about $1.9 million in relief. But they also bring in a player who's like signing him to a... They basically signed Dadonov to a one-year, $5 million contract. Hoffman's got 2 years left at 4.5. Dvorak's got 3 years at 4.45. Gallagher's locked in at 6.5. Suzuki's locked in at 7.8. Josh Anderson's 5.5. Now, reportedly, teams are really pushing to get Josh Anderson, and Montreal's just not budging on it. But in a year from now, Cole Caulfield and Ryan Poehling are both going to be RFAs. Michael Pezzetta's an RFA now. Rem Pitlick's an RFA right now. And Alexander Romanov is an RFA right now. But this player, apparently, according to policy 10.2 in the clause, said this player has not accrued the necessary amount of professional seasons required for Group 2 RFA statuses. They are ineligible for an offer sheet. So they just own Romanov, and they will figure what to do, figure out what to do with him, and they can take all the time in the world. But Montreal didn't have a lot of cap space, so adding on this player means they're probably not going to be active unless it's getting a player off their roster. I will be very, very intrigued to see what they do in the next coming weeks as well, but that's a big deal. That helps out both organizations a pretty substantial amount, gives Montreal another player, and then they can figure out, because I'm assuming Carey Price, if he doesn't play anymore, they got to figure out that trade, which also has a no movement clause, so we'll see how that plays into effect as well. And the final piece of news I want to get to here is reportedly the Chicago Blackhawks are in fact fielding offers for Alex DeBrincat. Now, DeBrincat, who analytically was off the charts, he's just 24 years of age, hit a career high 41 goals, 78 points, and in his 5-year career has averaged 35 goals and 68 points per 82 games. 5'7" winger has one more year left on his deal at $6.4 million before becoming a restricted free agent with arbitration rights. And in 2024 will be an unrestricted free agent if he so hits it. What's interesting here is that it looks like the Blackhawks are potentially rebuilding, retooling. I don't know if they're blowing it up or not. But it's a little bit more surprising that they wouldn't want to rebuild or retool around a 24-year-old who scored 41 goals last year and not potentially move off of guys like Patrick Kane or Jonathan Toews. Now, the difference is they are both in their final years of their 8-year $64 million extensions or $84 million extensions they signed in 2014. So those contracts are finishing up soon. Maybe Chicago wants to hang on to those two guys for a little bit longer. They can re-sign them to maybe a little less money. Maybe Toews takes a little bit less, though Patrick Kane is just continuously crushing it. And I understand that teams are calling about DeBrincat, for sure. And that could all this report is. That the fact our teams are calling about DeBrincat in Chicago as a joke is like, sure, what are you offering us? But there was also a leak that came out saying that Chicago's return on DeBrincat is like a young core player, a very high-end prospect, and a first-round pick. So I'm surprised that that was out there. And if you've heard it before, you'll hear it here again. when something is leaked, whether it's about a team or a player, it's not leaked accidentally. Like, leaks happen on purpose. If you, let's just say you're living in the greater Toronto area right now. You want to know why right now you can barely find information on what Toronto's doing with Mikheyev, if they're trading for John Gibson, what's going on with the Jack Campbell front? Toronto's not leaking anything. They want absolutely, positively nothing out. The last thing I heard was that, remember there was a rumor about Toronto and Jack Campbell have not started talking negotiations. That's not a leak. That's just somebody had absolutely zero information and went, they're not talking. So that's all we have. And then Toronto media tries to make it a thing and they kind of branch out on it. But there have been some apparently conversations with them, but we have no idea how they've gone. We have absolutely no idea how those conversations have gone. We have no idea who they're looking for in the market. But it's interesting when a leak happens with a team or a player, they want it to happen. So right now, when you're hearing news about Chicago's taking offers or fielding calls for DeBrincat, this is what their expected return is. These are leaks that have been leaked by the team specifically, and whether it's to scare them or start some sort of bidding war for DeBrincat remains to be seen. But I'm very interested in why they would have DeBrincat on the market or taking calls for DeBrincat, because all it could have been was Chicago is basically hanging up the phone anytime a team brings up DeBrincat. Right? That would make sense. That would reassure me as a player. But the fact that they are fielding calls and listening, now maybe, again, at the very beginning I said it could be, all right, what do you got? And then they listen and they go, no, and hang up the phone. But then they said, here's what we're looking for. And that's interesting. I want to see how that front continues as we go on here. Okay, a couple other news points before we head on out of here. Apparently, Washington Capitals center Nicholas Backstrom underwent left hip resurfacing surgery on Friday. The team announced there is no specific timeline, but the club apparently noted he will begin his rehab and lengthy recovery process immediately. There's only been, I think, a couple of players who have actually done this surgery. The latest from what I read up was Ed Jovanovski, if you remember that name. Defenseman, he was kind of all about, he's mainly in, he played in Calgary, he played in Vancouver, he played in Florida, but he went over this, I think it was like a 16-month process, and he played 37 games and then retired. And right now, Nicholas Backstrom is, I believe, 35 or will be 35 soon, and it's not old by any stretch, but it's hockey old. And going in for so what I read from this too is the resurfacing surgery, when there's like a hip replacement surgery, they completely replace, like, I guess, like the joints and like the balls of where the hip sits. They replace them with like metal. And then it takes, I don't know, like 8 months or so to recover from it. But you can make a full recovery. Resurfacing surgery kind of like skims the joint and then they coat it in metal. So it's not fully replacing. It's just kind of like a tune-up, but it's a lot harder to come back from and play at a high level. And at some point down the line, the metal could wear and then you ultimately have to get a completely new hip surgery anyways. Don't ask me why this one was over the other one. That's just from my very non-doctor mindset. But it's interesting. It will be a tough sled for Backstrom. He will not be ready for the start of the season. I will say that. We'll see if I'm sure he'll have an opportunity to play again, but not an easy surgery. And hopefully he is okay and that everything works out. And we potentially see Nicholas Backstrom one more time afterwards. Report, apparently the Carolina Hurricanes have granted Ethan Bear permission to speak with other teams. He is an RFA this year. He had 14 points in 58 games. Now, he only played 16.05 per game. However, he's playing on a very good Carolina team and is just 24 years of age and was only making $2 million this past season. A team could buy low on a guy like Bear, who has a lot of potential, a lot of promise, and could potentially, you know, a team could really bank on him and go forward with that. But It'll be interesting to see. He could be a guy to go back to a team, maybe like Edmonton, who's looking for a cheaper option on the right side. Toronto could be an option for him too, but we'll see. Maybe he stays in Carolina as well. If there's a team that gets the best out of the defensive players, it's Carolina, but who knows at this point. All right, that's about it for today's show. Thank you again, as always, for listening in. We might not have any more hockey by the time this next podcast comes out on Tuesday, so enjoy the games that come your way. Enjoy the last little bit of hockey that we have. News will start picking up in the next little bit. The draft's coming up, then free agency, and it's going to be a lot of craziness. Enjoy it and stay safe out there. Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, ST Hockey Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. I will see you next week. Until then, that's a wrap.